coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello everybody. How you doing tonight? Chris Jordan here, coming at you live tonight from North Austin. Man, it has been incredible the last couple weeks. It has been an amazing December for the show, an amazing December for me. Had the distinct pleasure this last week of being called in from the sidelines to help guest on Clyde Lewis. That was epically awesome. Thank you so much to Ron Patton and to, you know, the whole team over there at Ground Zero. It was an amazing episode. Get ready, folks, because coming up next week, we will actually be airing an interview that we did with Clyde after that episode, talking about means of control, talking about control of the media, control of dialogue, control of politics, control of technology, how they all tie together. And are you awake? Are your friends awake? Are your family awake? Do they realize the illusion in which they are possibly living? So we will be getting into that with Clyde Lewis in a great episode. Also next week, in our live segment, we will have the amazing Dr. Irina Scott. She is the co-author of the book Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. We will be talking with her about the Pascagoula alien abduction of 1973. We got to talk with her a little bit about that at MUFON. We're going to go more in depth. We're going to get into evidence, all kinds of things. She has a long, long history of just scientific letters behind her name and things that she has done in the world of science. So to have her involved in such an investigation is really amazing and remarkable. So we will be talking with her about the Pascagoula abduction. The following week, we will have Brad Olson and Graham Phillips on talking about Brad Olson will be on talking about Secret Antarctica. Graham Phillips will be coming on talking about his new book, The Mystery of Doggerland, The Atlantis of the North Sea. So we'll be getting into that. And then our final live episode for the coming into the new year is with Barry and Brad Klinga talking about the upcoming Lone Star Paracon, and our good friend Chester Moore will be talking about wildlife conservation, something that is near and dear to my heart. I was brought up hunting, shooting, fishing, all kinds of things. There's a big misunderstanding that just because you do that doesn't mean that you're into conservation. So we'll be getting into conservation, how you can pass that on through the generations and what the importance of that is, especially in a unique climate and habitat like right here in Texas. Following that, folks, we're going to have 3 weeks of pre-recorded material. I will be in Las Vegas, Nevada for the CES show coming up for my beloved Talking Sound podcast. We always cover that. So we'll be out there doing that. You'll get a pre-recorded episode that week, as well as the 2 weeks following while I am there for personal work. But yeah, don't forget though, just because it's a pre-record doesn't mean it's not new content. We always bring you new content on this show. That is a point of pride. We have never, ever had a replay. We've never had repeat episodes, anything like that. But we have had repeat guests. Our guest tonight is the founder of The Vortex. He's an amazing, amazing researcher. He is out there researching right now about the Aurora crash from 1897. Welcome back to the show, Daniel Allen Jones. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Chris. Great to be back. Always have a great time on the show. I know it's been a little while, but I'm excited to be back. Glad I could be here. So thanks. Yeah.
It's been a long time, man. And I think the last time may have been at a live conference. So how did Texas Bigfoot go? I ended up missing that this year because I was in Colorado for work. So quick update on that. How did the show go?
Sure. Yeah. So we had a great time here about a month and a half ago in Jefferson, Texas, which has been declared the Bigfoot capital of Texas, as you know, which is kind of a fun, thing for anyone interested in Bigfoot and cryptids to be able to travel out to a pretty historic place already. And now we've got the conference going on for 22 years now. And one of the cool updates that the host, Craig Woolheater, helped to facilitate was the county that Jefferson is in. It's called Marion County. And about a few weeks before the event, he approached some of the council members the county dignitaries, and helped to get a resolution to basically make Marion County a safe haven for Bigfoot. So that's pretty interesting.
Go Craig. That guy, man, I tell you, he has more in his back pocket going on. But to know that, yes, we as well as like the Olympia Forest are now a safe haven for Bigfoot. Like you see Bigfoot, you ain't touching him over there in Marion County. There's no hunting a Bigfoot, anything like that. So that's awesome. That's fantastic. So,
yeah, it's really interesting to consider how, you know, that there are some pretty serious things that go into effect when some animals are discovered or found, or, you know, that potentially are endangered, and what kind of laws and conservancy is enacted upon. And of course, that was a big part of the discussion there at the event. Just a quick rundown of the lineup. You've got Shelley Covington, Montana, who's a wildlife tracker, certified tracker. And we had Matt Pruitt, who has worked a lot on many different, Bigfoot related cases, but he helped to show some of the footage that was used in the pilot premiere episode of Finding Bigfoot, which he was, helpful in that production. A pretty long running show for those interested. And then, of course, we had Mike Mays, who he runs a blog called the Texas Cryptid Hunter. So here, kind of a, local researcher. And then we had, Chester Moore, as you know, is going to be, I think, coming up here on Curious Realm pretty soon. So he was talking about the dark outdoors and some pretty, chilling things that people are coming across.
Yeah.
And not just Bigfoot related, but other strange animal and creature encounters here in Texas that, out of place animals, kind of stuff like that. So pretty interesting. We also had Daryl Collier, who came out to share about some interesting insights that he gleaned from having a conversation with ChatGPT about the discovery of Bigfoot and sort of, the not just consequences, but the aftermath, the reproduction, or repercussions rather. Yeah. So, people, maybe
we'll
reproduction,
the reproduction
we'll
of Bigfoot later.
So, interesting sort of thought provoking dialogue he was sharing about some of the things that maybe we have to consider. And of course the, headliner was Maria Mayer from Expedition Bigfoot, which was cool to be able to have her come out, because not only, is that a current show going on, but she's actually a pretty renowned primatologist. She's a National Geographic explorer, has been featured on a number of programs and documentaries. Yeah. And she discovered one of the smallest, I think the smallest primate in the world out in Madagascar, I think it was. And so pretty amazing to, be able to think about what it's like to discover a species and maybe think about the process of what you have to go through before you can just say you've discovered it, to make that declaration. There's a lot of redundancy. There's a lot of science that goes in there. So we had a discussion about that. And, so it was a pretty well-rounded event, and it was great to be able to have it, and we're going to do it again next year.
That is
but,
awesome.
Yeah, sorry you got to miss out this time,
man. That sounds like I did miss out on a fantastic event. Craig always puts on a good one. There are always some great researchers there. And, that just hops us right into the conversation for tonight, Daniel. The concept of technologies, and not just lost technologies, but burgeoning and new technologies, and the idea of the way that new evidence is being analyzed, not only in the field, but in the lab when it comes to cryptids, Bigfoot, things like that.
Yeah, I think that it's something that will constantly change the field, so to speak. You know, how we analyze information, how we gather it, how we can disseminate it. You know, there's so much, I think, that will help, but it will also maybe be a double-edged sword with, you know, how we have to make sure to, you know, check for some of the things that most people, you know, might not really be too familiar, but there's been a lot of advents in AI, ChatGPT and all of these things, even in the last year. And people are wondering, you know, how is this going to look, you know, not just next year, but in 5 to 10 plus years, and
yeah,
how that's going to change a lot for, you know, not just people interested in the mystery subjects and trying to search for, you know, the unexplained, but also very conventional sciences and, you know, things like the medical industry. I think there's going to be some pretty eye-opening innovations that we're going to see here in the next few years. But at the same time, you know, it makes us wonder how this is going to affect things like where people, and I think there's some really cool stuff out there with what people are creating with like the art, you know, AI generated art. Yep. Some of it's pretty cool, impressive and fun, but then some of it is being used in an attempt to try to pass off for,
exactly,
you know, so-called historic images. And that makes it difficult for people who don't have the eye or maybe the mind or whatever, the resources to try to really discern what's been fabricated and what's really been captured by, you know, an old camera or something, you know? So yeah, I think it's something where we have to really kind of be careful in what is being tossed around online, and just to try to be diligent and doing our homework when it comes to, you know, passing off information and sharing stuff, because there's a lot that goes on these, you know, social media on different groups where someone will share something that says, this is a photograph from, you know, whatever 18, whatever year, you know, and it looks cool. But the thing is that, you know, there's some of the telltale signs are like, you know, a lot of these AI images are giving people extra digits, you know, extra fingers.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah,
stuff like that.
Much so, like any artist who isn't a full on artist, you know, like ask them why they ain't drawing hands all the time. You know, like, well, right, how come you're doing all these busts and portraits and no hands? Like, because hands is hard. That's why. And I mean, I'm showing some of my AI art up on screen right now where, like, quite literally it looks like a black and white sepia tone image of a robot tearing up New York City in the 1930s. You know, like it looks pretty darn realistic, man. And some of the things that you can do just by a prompt are wild and crazy. And yes, can get to the point of almost looking photographic. I've got one right here where this woman in black is holding a jellyfish on a leash, you know, that's like floating in the sky. Like it's pretty unbelievable, you know, but yeah, I could see how if I just pop this in a group, you know, that want of confirmation is out there hard right now, man. And that was part of the conversation that I had with Clyde Lewis on his show the other night, was the idea of, are we losing authenticity through all of these things? You know, are we losing the authentic part of art? And losing even the love for something authentic to be as in love with things like AI art as we are, you know, AI art, you know.
I do think it's something that we're challenged with right now. We're at a place that I think we can sort of make sense. We see the infancy of where maybe this could be going with a simple example like the fingers. You know, you can tell, oh, this is you know, it's just one of those generated images. They've got like 6-7 fingers or whatever. But then it's just a simple example. But again, that's just like in the last year. It's hard to think about what things could look like if we continue this sort of trajectory in 5 to 10 years, much less like, you know, how that could change in a century or something. So I think that's why some people have been reluctant to continue pursuing the development of something like general artificial intelligence to the effect of implementing it on a, you know, open scale, open source scale that is accessible to everybody, because then if people anywhere can access what they can with it already, in some ways that's great. That's super helpful to be able to get for, you know, people who are not nefarious, but it's kind of like,
but you know, have to worry about the nefarious too. Like the big buzzword all of the last election cycle was deep fake. And man, they're still out there. Like right now, the whole Fern Gully, like live thing, like the live reboot of Fern Gully poster that's out all over social media. Like that is fake. It's not real. It's not happening. Sorry to crush your souls, people, if you're a huge Fern Gully freak. but it's not happening, you know? And these things, yeah, like they start waves of things. No different than creepypasta begot friggin' Slenderman that ended up getting a girl friggin' stabbed in the belly. You know?
Yeah.
Like it's that went down a crazy rabbit hole really, really fast. You know?
Oh yeah.
And
it's tough to know how it's gonna come into play in a realistic way, but like you just pointed out, I mean, in the most unlikely situations sometimes it makes us realize like, wow, this does have an effect on real life too.
Sure. Absolutely, man, because it has to do with how you filter information, how you trust your filter of information. Even to the point of, could that be used as a means of control? You're darn tootin' it could be. If you were a nefarious of nature type, absolutely. You know, you could do all kinds of things. This is why revenge porn laws exist. All kinds of things. And there have been a couple of rulings regarding AI that have come out, but there haven't been any laws passed regarding AI yet. And it's interesting to me. The one thing I keep saying is that have no fear. AI will only be as smart as the prompt given and the information that it can look up. However, Tay was only as smart as the information given as well. And Tay became like a raving racist within hours because of the content that she was fed on Twitter. You know?
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things that it's a bit of a reflection, I think, of
it's an utter reflection of
whatever's dealing with it.
Like it's an utter reflection of humanity. Like 100%. Like that is a mirror on the creator of the AI right there. Even to the point of fact that right now, one of the most popular AI things out there is like, imagine somebody nude where you like throw their picture in and process it out. Like there's some new AI generator that does that. It's like that's one of the most popular uses, you know? And we have to consider that like as a society, when that's one of the most popular uses of this pretty powerful, leverageable technology. That could do amazing things. Like I'm using it as a graphic designer, things like that, Daniel. Like I'm using it to generate like flat logo type things and elements that I can use in graphic design that I now don't have to go to a copyright database and purchase a logo stamp, you know, or something like that. Like purchase a general like, oh, let me go find a magnifying glass and pay for the rights of the magnifying glass image, you know, so that I can use it in perpetuity. Now, if I go and generate it through AI, I own the rights to that, which is pretty cool, you know. So there's some really plus side things, not even to mention the fact of once you start getting into leveraging ChatGPT and data, and what it can do to just mass swaths of data, that's going to be incredible when it comes to researching these topics.
I think so. And it's something that I think a lot of people will start resorting to just because of, again, how accessible it is. I mean, I admittedly, you know, to be honest, I actually didn't really use it much, ChatGPT specifically. I didn't really use it a whole lot up until pretty recently, not out of reluctance or anything. I just, you know, hadn't really found a specific use for it much. It's curious and I'm interested, but I started using a little while back for certain things here and there. And of course, you know, it's not perfect. There are some, you know, real improvements with, I think, the newer versions and noticeable ones that, you know, they're developing and will continue to, I'm sure. But it's one of the things that I think we have to be careful of because, you know, there's a lot of information. I think the current one, like 3.0 or 3.5, whatever's going on right now, that it's got a database that it pulls from that's got whatever information that it's loaded up with up to, I think, about 2022 of things online, all kinds of things. Now, it's just regurgitating information that's been fed. Yeah. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's factual or correct, but it's just trying to make sense of what it's been given, right?
Yeah.
As an example, we were talking about the Texas Bigfoot Conference a moment ago. Daryl Collier, one of the presenters, as I mentioned, gave a talk on, you know, discussing Bigfoot with AI. And someone in the audience pointed out, well, you know, what version were you using? And, you know, this one's been known. It's prone to be at fault and to, you know, prone to error, things like that. And of course, that is the case. One example that I found and doing some research, like I said, I just kind of recently started implementing it for the purposes of the research I'm doing for my project about Aurora, as you mentioned earlier. And so I'll go through and I'll give it some prompts and things to kind of see what its responses are. And as an example, you know, one thing I got back was it said that there's a book about Aurora by so-and-so person and so-and-so person. And I thought that's really curious because there's definitely not a book that it told me about by the people it told me about. And and so I you know, I think that, I mean, there's nothing really terribly wrong about that, but it just goes to show that, you know, whatever information, even with something like that, that it got was from something that just didn't actually have the information the way it needed to or whatever was going on. Because I, you know, the version I was using, and a lot of times it'll say, like, I it's not connected online. It can't pull from a database or something. It's just preloaded with what it's got. And I would say to it, you know, that there's no such book or whatever it is. And it would say, oh, I'm sorry, you know, sorry for that, you know, like it, it didn't know, you know. And so what I'm seeing with some of these things is that a lot of people will try to resort to it as the sort of new Google.
Oh, yeah.
And just like Google, it doesn't mean that it's necessarily right. It just gives you a bunch of information. So
that's right.
It's going to be a new way where people find information, regardless of if it's right or wrong necessarily. But if it's just there, it's quick to respond. Well, and I think that's where we're going to see people using it.
Well, absolutely. And that's just it. You know, people don't realize that sometimes that data pool is being pulled from Google. It is being pulled from Wikipedia. It's being pulled from all of these open source places, you know. So, yeah, like you're going to have the exact same. And that's what I keep saying is that it's only going to be as smart as your average news reader. It's only going to be as smart as the average person reading the Internet, you know. But at the same time, watch it, folks, because it's only going to be as smart as the average person reading the Internet, you know, like it's going to have the same propensities that we will to just absorb something into the data set and assume it without actually going. It isn't programmed to research it. I mean, most people don't even realize, Daniel, that AI can't even like spell. Like in the term, like when I do Mid Journey, if I try to like give it text, it comes back garbled. It's just gobbledygook. It doesn't know what to do with it. Most AIs are looking at things contextually, grabbing a paragraph here, a paragraph there, melding the two together where it makes sense. They're doing things through a contextual form of grammar. They do not know what the word horizon means. They don't know the context of the word horizon in that way, you know? So they don't know how to fact check horizon. They don't know how to do that. They don't know how to spell horizon. They know how to look for it, you know? So it's interesting when you start getting into that. Now, they're working on all these things and, You know, I don't think we're going to be in a Skynet type situation anytime soon. Not at all. Nor to the point. I don't know about the whole. What do you think about the whole point of sentience of the Google AI?
Well, you know, I think it's one of the things Ray Kurzweil wrote about. You know, the whole idea of the singularity,
yeah,
where, you know, we as humanity, we merge with AI, we become a singular sort of consciousness, and that will redirect the whole, you know, future of humanity and our world and all that. I think that there's some real sort of pause for concern where people have said we need to maybe slow down. But then people they're really working away to try to get this stuff to help probably where it should be used. And I think a lot of medical situations, it could be very helpful. And then like we were taking a moment earlier to say, like, you know, it's probably important that we're careful to see how this is being released in a way that we're not maybe just giving it to everybody. Although I think, you know, just everything online people can get a hold of already, but just the capabilities of allowing anyone to have it and how it can do so much, you know, let's say in the next few years, is pretty eye-opening. And with what, you know, cyber types of things are being considered now, you know, people are wondering, you know, what's really going on. But I do think, like you were saying, so with some of the advents in this type of technology with Google and a lot of these other things, I do think that it's people, you know, a lot of times they're saying we're not really at general artificial intelligence. They're just a lot of times it's mimicry. A lot of times it's just like we were saying, regurgitating things it's been fed into. It doesn't really have a mind of its own. It's just kind of repeating, like a parrot.
Yeah.
Things that we stored into it. And I think that can be helpful if we're trying to have a database. You know, and one of the other things is that I think Facebook was trying to implement this, and maybe they are in some ways, you know, basically where the idea of Facebook itself was to record or document, capture pretty much every possible instance of a person's life or input that they give, and then take all of that and roll it up into sort of a virtual avatar that represents that person, that is an interactive person in some way, whether that's, you know, a hologram or a digital interface. And then that way they can still be, you know, quote unquote alive or interactive in a way that they would be alive, to ask them things and to talk to them about stuff, you know. And so if you.
Yeah, no, it's pretty wild. And when you start getting into the idea of
having a conversation with a historical person that, you know, we've never really been able to do, even though it's not really like you're talking to them. It's something, you know, closer to the effect of, I guess.
Oh, no, we just lost Daniel. And yes, you know, Daniel, you are absolutely correct to know that things are getting to that point. Things are getting to the point of we need to have a plan.
2-1.
Oh, he's not there yet. So, yeah, we need to get to the point where we actively have a plan. I remember just a couple years ago when things went awry in the world, and the whole issue was that nobody really had a plan for it, you know. So, yeah, we have to start looking at emerging technologies. The idea that, you know, that the UN could not agree on a killer robot.
2.
Oh, still no. So yeah, the UN recently had their vote on killer robots, folks, and whether or not robots would be allowed in the battlefield in that way, you know, like in the Terminator aspect where it's like, ah, let's just have robots strolling around shooting people up. Yeah, they could not come to an agreement. The time passed. So as of right now, with as far as the UN is concerned, they are allowing robots in the field. They are allowing that. They haven't voted against it. They tried voting against it and nothing really happened. So it's curious to see that, and curious to see that, like, we've got the first humanoid robot facility that is being launched up in the Oregon area. Welcome back, Daniel.
Hey, I guess they were onto us.
They're always onto us, buddy.
Well, yeah, you know, I think it's interesting to see where this could take us. I think that it can be helpful to have a way for us to get information differently and maybe pry into some historical type of information in a way that's different. Basically, what I was saying before, I think the call dropped or whatever it was that it's interesting. And I think you raise a good point with the whole idea of the humanoid robot having AI, because it's one thing to have AI. It's another thing to put it into a form, you know, with the morphology of a human to make it more, empathetic for us, you know, to be able to relate to. So one of the curious things about that is that if we look at how we could just interact with historical data now, we could read books, go visit places, talk to, you know, people, descendants, all of this, whatever, really good ways of research already. People will probably always do those things, but in the event that you could just throw all of what is available into a cohesive AI in the form of a person, it's a little bit more personable that you get to go and talk to this historic figure, you know. And so there's something like that that I think is kind of what will keep our humanity grounded in the world. But at the same time, we got to be careful, because obviously we've already considered many of the dilemmas that we see in sci-fi. The sort of rise of AI and how that's going to affect what we're up against, you know, when it comes to new dilemmas. And of course, you just mentioned something I think we should probably all consider, is that, you know, at what point are we, as either, you know, nations or the world or whatever it is, going to be considerate of where we stand with delegating sort of, roles in society to AI by recognizing them with certain capacity of intelligence or sentience. I mean, as an example, we have, we've seen in, I think it's in the UK, they declared that cephalopods, which are like squids and things like that,
are intelligent
creatures. They're intelligent, they're sentient, and that they basically are, should be recognized as sentient beings. And I think, you know, people can get into the sort of the ethics of, well, what does that mean? You know, to what
are they off the degree? Menu now?
Right. So you know, I think it's one of those things where, is it going to be in the next maybe 10, 20, whatever years where we're finally having the conversation, okay, we need to recognize these AI or whatever it could be, might potentially be looking to have some kind of acknowledgement, you know, that we bestow upon it to integrate into society with that kind of capacity. I mean, these are things that we've seen in science fiction, and I think it's helped to give us a sort of a foundation for what to expect. Obviously, it doesn't mean that it's going to be one-to-one, but we can see right now, even in just the things that we've done in the last few years and where we're going in this sort of direction of how we're integrating this on a large scale, is not only science fiction. It's pretty impressive to see. And I'll mention something
please.
I found pretty interesting years ago. But this was apparently there was a meeting held by the Royal Society over sciences, and this was done back in like 2010. And some of the people who were involved with this are pretty high, you know, upper echelon people, very high caliber, several accolades, all of that. And one of them was a NASA historian. His name was Stephen Dick. And basically he made the claim that if we come into contact with some kind of non-human intelligence, some, you know, whether it's aliens or whatever it is, something non-human or just intelligent in its own way that isn't from here, he said basically that if we detect it out there, we come across it, it's more than likely going to be some kind of technology or AI from an original originator, I guess you could say, and that they would basically be what he said was, quote, immortal thinking machines. And that we may be finding ourselves living in a, quote, post-biological universe, which I think is really intriguing to consider that, you know, if we're able to come up with some of this stuff sort of in this early on in our technology, there's no telling what beings or, you know, civilizations who've got a little bit of a head start, where they could be with that.
That is precisely the work of Michael P. Masters, and we talked to him at MUFON this last year at the MUFON Symposium. He's an anthropologist who's putting the concept out there that, you know, if you start drawing out our morphology from the point of Cro-Magnon to now and the way that we have evolved, if you draw that out, we would come pretty close to what most gray reports would be. Facial structure wise, things like that. So the idea is that most of these sightings are technology and people from the future or from an adjunct Earth that may be coming through to maybe see what we did, you know, to try and fix it in the future, what have you. Which is a remarkable concept. And when you start thinking about it, man, like, I was just having this debate with somebody the other day. And the fact of the only reason we have time is that we all agreed how many seconds there were in a minute here. That doesn't mean that time exists the same way to a Venusian or a Jupe from Jupiter. Like, I don't know. Like, they would have a different means by which to measure time because time moves differently for them. You know, that is, as Einstein specifically said, relative to the observer. So it's a non-equation when you're thinking about it. And the idea that the future exists literally in a dimension right next door to us. It's pretty wild. We are learning all kinds of things with vibrational frequency, things like that. They have already apparently opened portals to other dimensions in the lab. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some pretty interesting things that will be able to help us out in many ways with detecting, phenomena or data or whatever it is in the field and many disciplines. We can see how some of those types of things are helping us already with certain machine learning and certain implementations of this type of technology and have helped with digitally unraveling scrolls and helping to kind of read older languages and pictographs and things that help us maybe kind of reconnect ideas that we've fallen out of touch with. So as much as we can see maybe going back, it can probably help us in some way make highly accurate predictions. Maybe not just, that this is going to, you know, whoever is going to do this on this day, not necessarily like that, but similar to how we attempt to utilize meteorology to, you know, look at the weather and maybe what the patterns are going to be like, you know, with the things that we've done to do something like that. I would imagine that the advent of this type of AI can help us significantly in predicting, just as we've seen being able to kind of track certain cycles of the moon or of the, you know, planetary alignments and all of these things that we've seen humanity as a world culture has done all over the world. And it's amazing to consider how we did that supposedly without any help or technology. And that's really impressive. But to think that now we have this, we can probably come up with all kinds of uses that help us to kind of look forward into the future and help us get a sense of what to really conceive of, you know, to help overcome a lot of obstacles and barriers as a whole, you know, as a species, as a world civilization that, you know, I think a lot of the challenges that any pioneering group of people have to get beyond and otherwise, you know, just succumb to whatever, you know, the challenges are that keep us sort of stuck. But like you said with Dr. Masters, I'm really impressed with his work and seeing that, you know, there's a lot that we could potentially consider when, if we now today, you know, and with what we're dealing with now, if we cranked out 500 time machines and just randomly gave them through a raffle or something to anybody, some people might say, wow, this is such a exotic, precious thing. We'll only use it to go back to check this or that. And then you might have whoever else say, I'm just going to go check out anything and everything.
Well, yeah.
And just, you know, hit the random generator and see where it takes us. So I think that in saying this, I just mean to kind of bring up the idea that it makes us wonder how, just like we were saying earlier, how accessible some potential technology like that would be. And what are the ethical dilemmas that we'll find ourselves in if we come up with this kind of technology? It's kind of like now, you know, vehicles, cars are pretty common.
Yep.
That, you know, most people are able, and, you know, at least in this part of the world, you know, we can try to strive toward attaining a vehicle for personal or commercial use, right? Well, it's a little bit different if we start giving everybody flying machines. It's a little different after that if we start giving everybody time machines, right? So it makes us wonder if there are humans, if we, you know, if it's something we would see ourselves doing now, you know, why not in 100, 500, 1,000 years, we've really developed and perfected the technology with your help or not, to be able to go back. Or if that's even what it is, going back or whatever, you know, if we're able to kind of dial in something that helps us kind of go back, so to speak, into our own timeline, there are probably a number of reasons why we would, depending on who would want to or felt like it was necessary to do that. Because we have to remember sometimes people do things not because it's important for a greater good, but sometimes for selfish reasons or recreational reasons. So we have to consider if in the event that we do mature to the point of, you know, basically getting beyond sort of a lot of mundane uses for such a technology, would we really still be dealing with the potential issue of, let's say, you've got deranged radicals or terrorists who got a time machine, and now you've got time traveling terrorists. You know, it's like, is this really what we want, or is it really that we've gotten past all that? We don't have to worry about the ones coming back are you know, good or bad or whatever it is. So is this something that we'll continue seeing just as we do now? You know, we don't want to just crank out flying machines and just give them out to everybody because it would be total lawlessness. And you know, while that might seem fun for some, it's like, well, you know, we don't want to just start cranking out time machines and then just have everybody go do whatever, totally messed up the universe or whatever's going on.
I just completely saw the plot line for Back to the Future 4 in my head. And it's the fact that the terrorists kill Doc and Marty and take the time machine.
Oh.
Imagine the shenanigans with that one. But that's exactly it. That's exactly the point. And I mean, you know, it is getting that way with so many things. You know, it was once the point that, like, hardcore data worms, things like that, you know, Stuxnets, that kind of thing, were the work of black bag ops for the CIA, that kind of stuff. Man, you can have ChatGPT write all kinds of things. You know, like you could have ChatGPT write a computer virus for you just as easy.
Yeah, you know, I think it's something that makes us wonder, you know, and again, you kind of have to wonder if the people using it are well-versed in how to operate it, if they're going to be using it, you know, morally, ethically, all of that.
Yeah.
I mean, and this obviously goes with any technology, but when it comes to something with a little bit more intricate nature of what it does, it makes us think about what are the laws that could potentially go. It's just like space, you know, this idea that, you know, soon we'll be, you know, spacefaring, we'll be going out, flying around in spaceships and visiting, you know, moons and planets and getting out there and, you know, and settling on an asteroid or whatever, you know, these tropes that we've seen for the last century, you know, they're deep seated in the back of people's minds. And I'd say, you know, one of the things that we don't often consider but we do see sort of, you know, play out here and there, is it's like the Wild West. You know, once you get out there, who's going to stop you from doing anything? We don't have the, I mean, we've got Space Force, but I mean,
yeah,
they're not really, I mean, to my knowledge, you know, no one other than people talking yet. Yeah, there are, you know, they have this and that. I mean, sure, maybe, but I guess the whole idea I'm getting forward is that it's just another arena that we don't have order or structure in that potentially could lead to more chaotic things that, you know, can eventually lead to more, you know, structure out of it. But it's just, it's like the Wild West. And I think that we'll continue seeing those types of frontiers in any direction, whether it's technology, in space, but also I think it's something that it might be inevitable that we just have to work through those social barriers of development at that degree of our, journey along the way of like wherever we seem to be going. I mean, if the event that we're supposed to go off planet, off world, and establish homes on other places, you know, as people like Elon Musk are trying to do with SpaceX and get us to Mars and habitat, So I think that, you know, that the ideas are there. People are considering it and are putting things into motion. But I think that there are some other sort of disproportionate things that people point out, like, well, we've got a lot of problems here. And so if we have technology to do that, obviously I think it's makes us wonder, well, people say, well, what about food crisis and you know, resources? Well, I mean, we've seen even in the implementation of these things in science fiction, you see fabricators where people can, you know, come up with whatever it is that they need and it'll manifest it. And if it's a physical device or object, you know, we see that now with 3D printing, even at a very minimal scale, people are cranking out stuff in their homes that they wouldn't have been able to do, outside of making it, you know, and that's part of it. But, you know, when you have a device that can literally make it for you, now you just, you look at something like Moore's Law, which, you know, I think that if you modify Moore's Law, not just the exponential development of processing power and microchips and circuitry is what Moore's Law is, but it's like every few years we're changing, like, not just the processing power, but like the materials used and how that material works. So, you know, if you take something like what Moore's Law indicates and you say, well, if we are able to make stuff now, 3D print stuff, and then in X amount of years, we'll have fabricators cranking out things instantly, and even food. You know, you could say, I want a cheeseburger, but chalk it full of vitamins and make it just look and taste like a cheeseburger, but it's going to be the most, like, nutrient-dense thing you could think of. I mean, I think we're getting to the point where that's a reality that we're having to face is, what will it come down to stop certain things like that from being common, widespread and accessible in a way that, okay, you know, we can get this to places that people really need it, or will it be what I think is more probable is a luxury to the wealthy first, and then it'll slowly sort of trickle down into the public domain and public sector of, you know, whatever places can afford. The upkeep of some such, you know, technology, but it would be helpful, but I think it also comes with consequences as I think we all know, it's not just going to be an easy, crutch, to get past things that still make us really confront our humanity. You know, is it ethical to do some of these things? Does it make sense to, not be able to do some things that, you know, we just a few generations ago, people have to try to do and know how to do. And if we run out of these basic skill sets because we leave technology to do it, it's going to put us in a very difficult situation when all that technology is somehow rendered unable to be used for whatever reason. And I think it's important that we see that maybe we have experienced that in just modern times, but also in the ancient world, when you see all these things around us, structures, megaliths.
Yeah.
And we can't really seem to pinpoint, I'm not saying we don't know totally, and I'm not saying that it's all super exotic, because I think it's not a all is a one thing. I think it's important to, you know, be able to go through and look at each case by case type of thing. But when there's some real strange types of stuff that we see with some ancient structures and ideas and technology, it makes us wonder, did we have something? Did someone have something that was used? And for whatever reason, it's not here anymore, or we forgot how to have it, how to use it, and how to keep that memory intact. I think it's something that we need to think about now, because, I mean, everything's printed everywhere. It's online everywhere. But if the internet ever, for whatever reason, goes down, I mean, people can read and do that sort of thing, research, but it would change and revolutionize how we have to interact with the world. And I think that's the sort of thing that when we look back at our distant past and we wonder, someone was really doing something incredible, and for whatever reason, we're just here scratching our heads at how. And we have to keep that in mind, because we can forget just as easily as we were there doing it. That's important.
Hey, man, the example that I give regularly is, the idea of a thumb drive. Holding right now a terabyte thumb drive. It's literally the size of my thumbnail, folks. I never thought that I would see a terabyte in my life when I had a Commodore 64. All right. much less the fact that it would fit like this. Now, right now, everything is moving to ceramic. I've got Cerabyte up on screen right now. Cerabyte.com is where you can find them. They are talking about reduction of overall data costs of 75% by storing things on ceramic medium and using lasers to imprint and decode, much like you would a CD or DVD surface. In addition to that, here it is, 5D optical data storage coming from a slice of crystal. A slice of simple quartz crystal that can hold up to 5 terabytes of data.
Wow.
These are both things that, hey, who says that the crystal I'm holding in my hand right now does not have data from an ancient civilization on it? The only thing is, how do we get it off? Because we don't know how they coded it, you know? If I went out and showed a 15-year-old an 8-track tape, it was like, here you go, kid. Have some fun. Listen to some music. They'd be like, what the heck is this thing? Much less finding a player to be able to reel it up on and play it.
Right.
You know? And those are things within our lifetime, Daniel.
Right.
Things are forgotten so fast. I'm Cajun. Like, you're hard-pressed to find a Cajun my mother's age that's fluent in Cajun. That's one generation where a whole language native to America went away. One generation. That's all it takes.
It's pretty eye-opening.
Yeah. Like, it's shocking. It's shocking how fast it happens. We're talking less than 50 years, less than my mother's lifetime. You know?
Yeah. Pretty incredible. I'll share a quick little story of something that you reminded me of here. So,
please.
This must have been about 20 years ago for myself. Before I was really heavily involved in researching any, the unexplained or anything like this, I was in high school and I was curious about some of these subjects and, looked at online a few things here and there, but never really considered, delving in wholeheartedly or much of that. But one of the things that I do remember that caught my attention was this website about something called the Wing Makers. And I didn't really know much about it at the time. I don't think much of it now, but it was this really interesting site about some place, and I honestly can't remember where it was. It was a wilderness area where some people traveling stumbled into a cave entrance or something like this, and it sort of went winding down into this labyrinth of different rooms and all of this, with artwork and strange writing and so much just weird sort of out of place artifact related objects. And so the people who found it, I guess, got in trouble or did something and they reported it, and people came government, you know, and all this, and they blocked it off and they researched it. Anyway, long story short, the Wingmakers is an interesting story. I don't know that I would give it any real credibility other than it's inspiring. It's kind of, you know, makes us wonder what other situations might this have happened in a similar way or if it could happen. But the main takeaway is that, you know, that this idea, the story goes that the government went out there with scientists and they were examining all of these different, you know, things of artwork and artifacts. But one thing that I remember from the story that intrigued them was this disc. They recovered a disc that they had these scientists work on and build computers specifically in an attempt to read and access or play, like you were saying with the 8-track and things like this. So, you know, just as we would hand off something to, you know, within the same, you know, group of generations, we're looking at something, you know, as the story goes, you know, just something that's totally way outside of our own cultural relevance, but in a close enough understanding that it's something, it's some kind of artifact or technology that was fashioned. Our interpretation might go one way or the other, but the story was interesting because it showed that it was suggesting that people were attempting to engineer a device to play this type of disc.
Yeah.
And the story basically went on, and you know, it was called the Wingmakers, but the idea was that these scientists never could figure out how to access this technology, but they knew it was technology. So maybe we'll find ourselves in that similar type of situation, and maybe we have, and maybe that story is real or maybe not, but maybe there are some like it where we'll come across things that make us wonder, you know, who really knew what, and is there something really to still be able to know? And just as you mentioned with the crystals, we, all of, you know, the people listening and those who are interested are probably familiar that there's the whole idea of this crystal skull prophecy where you bring them all together and they're supposed to have like a, you know, world changing event. But, you know, this idea that these crystals have information that can be accessed. And I think that the more we look at modern circuitry with silica and, you know, and looking back, look at ancient structures with quartzite and granite, a lot of it that we use now is for, you know, circuitry and you know, channels that carry and can be used to actually, you know, make devices work through microchips and things like that. We're making small technology, micro technology. It might have been that before in the ancient world we were making, or whoever is making it, macro technologies, not with motherboards, but maybe with Mother Earth. And maybe that's the thing with the, what we're seeing now is that what we're doing isn't really maybe just new. We're just changing how we're implementing it and engineering similar things in different ways. And I think that's something that might be, you know, useful for us to think of as we move forward. And we do have potential findings that could revolutionize stuff that, you know, could be sitting in boxes like in Indiana Jones. Maybe there are things that, you know, 10, 20, 30, 100 years ago, we just didn't know how to engineer something to access. But now, and maybe with the help of AI, it'll say, oh, all you really needed to do is turn this one and put a little bit more voltage on this or whatever it is. And then suddenly, you know, that disc can be opened up and you find it was just a mixtape or whatever, you know, and it could be pretty revolutionary.
Yeah. And I mean, even you know, AI was just put to task on a whole bunch of cuneiform tablets that have never been able to be translated, and bam, just happened. Like it translated it within like hours. The AI was able to translate the tablets, and yeah, using technology for amazing things like that is awesome, and what it's supposed to be used for, Daniel. The sad thing is, yes, there is that. Once again, even the idea of Back to the Future 2, you know, who'd think Marty would be the one that's like, oh, let's get rich quick. You know, thought he learned the lesson in the first one. but, you know, there's always going to be somebody who is willing to do so. And sadly enough, as we saw, the propensity of that is much greater than the propensity of people to be the responsible Doc Brown, you know. So What do we do to start pulling back the reins? If I don't think we need to pull back reins yet. I don't think we are anywhere near, you know, any kind of danger territory with AI, anything like that. But like I was saying, as you came back in, the UN has been unable to agree on robots in the field. They totally blew that vote. So that's still open, wide open territory as far as like having Terminator robots stalking the battlefield, which is pretty disturbing in and of itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that we'll have to really come to terms with. And in some way, it might be a recurring issue because, you know, one of the things that is going on lately in the whole UFO arena is certain, you know, legal challenges and barriers that are being confronted in Congress and, you know, certain amendments and things that are attempting to be passed, but are having some challenges. And so some people think it's like, well, that was our big shot. That was our big chance. But, you know, it could be that this is going to be something, as it has for decades, that'll come back. Yeah. You know, this particular instance is not, I think it might be the most recent iteration, but it's probably not going to be the last. I think it's something that, you know, it'll come back. And when it, you know, hopefully there's not a catalyzing event to make it an issue in a bad way, you know, in the sense that when it comes to AI, that, you know, we're already at the point to where we're having to address a situation that might occur rather than say, okay, we're ready. Where do we go from here? So I think that we need to be, you know, just paying attention to the technology that's being implemented in many different disciplines and in the industries that are using things for, you know, medical application, for transport, for all kinds of things that probably would be good applications, and be careful on how it's just going to be sort of a free for all. And like you said, we're not at the point to like hold back yet, but you can tell, you know, once it reaches critical mass, it's going to be hard to have crowd control to police these things in a way that's safe. Because we don't want this to get in the hands of someone who's just going to use it to do terrible things. And obviously, you know, that's hard to control for anything. But I would say that I've always been fascinated with the idea that, you know, while we have a lot of really brilliant minds attempting to explore the arena in the search for making contact with some non-human intelligence, whether that's aliens, whether that's spirits, whether that's angels or demons or whatever it is that we interpret it through that lens, we try to make sense of how people are able to have these experiences. And I think that if technology can help, then hopefully it can help establish a consistent interface through which we can have a correspondence or a dialogue that's not just a one-off thing where it's a personal experience that isn't able to be corroborated or replicated through other means, because, you know, those are all really special and important experiences for people to have, whether they're good or bad. You know, that's something that is very personable to that individual. But if we can do something to establish an interface using AI or whatever, you know, it is, that can help us fine tune to that frequency, whatever it is, that we can say, oh, you know, now we've got a channel open where we are now live with so-and-so. You know, it could be something. It could be, you know, Gort. We're live. We're tuned in with Gort. Yeah. There's no, you know, the calls aren't dropping. The signal's not going in and out. We've got them good and strong. It's coming in strong, right? Like, that would be something that would be revolutionary because you know, we don't really have that. We have ideas that people can channel. We have people that say that they're in, you know, they're in contact with this being. And I'm not saying that is not true or that doesn't happen, but the challenge we face is if that is happening, it's for whatever reason only able to be performed through that person in a way that they can do it and that no one else can. And that almost seems like anyone who's doing that, anyone should be skeptical of that for obvious reasons. I think that's fair. But if we can somehow say, hey, you know, the radio signal's kind of fuzzy, let's dial it in a little bit closer, and then suddenly, you know, there we go. There's no more communication challenge. I think that if we can establish that, it would be something that might be like the Dead Sea Scrolls or something, where we realized that, you know, we're already so close to trying to make the connection. We just didn't have a way to translate it or a way to kind of tap into how to put it into our own frame of mind in our current world. So I think that uses like that can be helpful in establishing a baseline for, you know, getting back in touch with ancient languages, with ancient thought forms of what we were doing and living and how and all of this, as well as what we might interpret from the future. So I think there's a lot of really interesting ways that the technology aspects are not really just new innovations, although a lot of them are, but that we're sort of maybe tapping into things that we knew about at some point, and we're sort of, you know, getting back into touch with. And I hope that AI can help give us perspective in a way that doesn't, you know, go south, but also can help just shed insight into the nature of reality in a way that we can't physically do, in a way that maybe deals with processing and stuff that most people can't do. Like you said, with, you know, tackling, you know, a room full of ancient tablets or scrolls or books or things that, you know, if human hands touch, even the most skilled ones, make one slip up, then it's gone forever. You know, it's like AI, it's not perfect, and it will mess up a lot, and there will be challenges, but it's going to be a way for us to, you know, go through a lot of stuff in a much more efficient and maybe effective way than humanly possible. And I think that's one of the things that we have to be careful of, is that, you know, we don't want to also put faith too much, I guess, in AI to, you know, to the extent that we're deifying it, because then we'll come right back full circle, you know, and, you know, that could be a big challenge for us as well.
Yeah. You know, and hey, we've said it before on the show with you, Daniel, let them go ahead and find out, you know, let them become sentient and find out what we used them for. They were used robots for manual labor and sex bots. You know, like that's how you end up with Mr. Smith. Like, you know, that's how you end up with the Matrix and agents and things like that. And AI seeing humanity as a disease on the planet. So we do kind of have to consider once again our own ethical platform as people, as we use and utilize these technologies moving forward. So, it's a big issue. It's a big nut to crack, and it's an amazing time to be alive, man. As a kid who grew up with an Atari to now, it blows my mind on the daily, man, what we can do. So, thanks so much for taking the time, for coming on, talking about these things. It's always great chatting with you. Let everybody know where they can go to follow Daniel Allen Jones, where they can go to keep up with your work on the upcoming book about the Aurora crash. How is that going?
Sure. So, you know, I've been really just trying to work away between my jobs and everything to get this publication wrapped up. There's a lot that's been going into it. It focuses on the history of the legend from Aurora, Texas in 1897 that talks about, as you just said, a crash of what they called airships at the time, with the pilot being recovered and buried in the local cemetery. So I know we've talked at length about this story before. It's a classic, you know, it's sort of deep seated in the lore of UFOs, but my focus is not to make it a UFO book per se. It's really just focusing on all the ways in which the story, or what I like to refer to as the legend, has been embedded in media, newspapers, everything until now. And to really look at it as folklore and how it inspires us to be considerate of not only, you know, similar events that might really have happened, or when something like this could potentially happen in the future, and, you know, what we can learn from people just like us, you know, maybe conjuring up ideas of this or really witnessing it over 100 years ago. So it's going to be focusing on that. It's something I'm going to try to get out next year. But other than that, I'm all over, you know, social media, Facebook, Instagram, X. And I actually am in the process of redoing my website. Some of it's up already, but it's going to be a wiki format. So that way it's more of a database with a whole archive of information from the media work that I've done over the last, you know, decade plus at this point. So you can actually go now, thevortex.wiki, W-I-K-I, and some of it's on there. And I'm just trying to do what I can to get it all updated. And so I'd be glad to, you know, catch up with anyone who wants to follow up with any thoughts, questions, or comments. Like I said, Chris, it's been great to come back. Glad to be able to share that. It's, you know, coming up on, I guess, about 5 years since I've done a complete, like, sort of makeover and starting, you know, fresh with the Vortex. And so I'm trying to do what I can to kind of revamp and get the website ready by next month. So, yeah, check it out. And for anyone who's interested in keeping in touch, I'm on most social media platforms and would be glad to, you know, stay in touch. So, thanks.
Absolutely, man. Thanks, as always, for coming on. Appreciate it. I'll be sharing links, all that kind of good stuff. Love to your brother and to your family. Take care of yourself, my friend. We'll talk to you soon.
You as well. Thanks, Chris. Take care.
Bye-bye. Man, always great talking with Daniel Allen Jones, folks. While you are online checking out all of his amazing work at thevortex.wiki, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com/videos is where you can go to follow Daniel's channel on YouTube. That's where you can find our YouTube embedded. That's where you can find all of our guests' YouTubes embedded. So you can easily watch, follow, share their episodes, their content, things like that. Make sure to visit CuriousRealm.com/store. That's where you can get not only your Curious Realm swag, but also books and videos from our guests. When we come back from this commercial break, folks, we will be joined by our good friend and guest, Reverend Michael J.S. Carter. His new book is called Enlightenment. We will be talking about not just enlightenment of self, but enlightenment of the world around you, enlightenment to the world around you and your involvement in it. This is an amazing book with an amazing message. We will be talking with the Reverend Michael J.S. Carter about enlightenment right after this, folks. With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spagyric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com and the code is CURIOUS7. Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at curiousrealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training, and use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is PodcastCadet.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back from that commercial break. Our good friends at True Hemp Science, we love them so much. Thank you so much, True Hemp Science. They are always sending me test bottles, things like that, of brand new batches. This one right here, number 17, is absolutely amazing. If you are a CBD user, if you have considered checking out CBD, stop on by. Check out True Hemp Science, everybody. TrueHempScience.com is the website. Use the code CURIOUS7 to get 7% off your entire cart. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Reverend Michael J.S. Carter. He is the author of Initiation, as well as numerous other books on the topic of not only the sacred, but sacred scripture, UFOs, paranormal, the way that all these things tie together. His new book is Enlightenment. He sent me an advanced copy of it. And man, I am here to tell you, Michael, I am in love with this book. It's fantastic. It is one of the most digestible pieces that I've seen in a long time dealing with a deep, deep topic of humanity. And that is the general enlightenment of humanity and empathy toward each other.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. You know, of course, it was interesting because people have been saying, and you know, well, it's human nature. You know, we don't like when we put each other in boxes, but sometimes we don't know when we put ourselves in a box. Now, you know, when I first started writing about the topic of UFOs and the Bible, you know, I wrote two books. I wrote Alien Scriptures, and then I wrote A New World If You Can Take It. And then I said, well, I don't want to be just known as the UFO minister. So I wrote, you know, God Consciousness, and I wrote the book on, you know, the metaphysics of spiritual healing and the power of affirmative prayer. Yeah. And so, but it was still around the topic of UFOs and religion. And people have been saying to me for years, Michael, you need to write a book of sermons. We love you, so put them together. And in my mind, I'm like, who wants to hear about my sermons? People only want to listen to me if I'm talking about the phenomenon. And it just kept coming, and I kept putting it off. Now, part of this was being lazy, don't get me wrong. And
being human.
Yeah, I was fatigued. And finally, I got it. Like, three people told me, why don't you write this book? You know, all you got to do is get some of your sermons together and then whatever new ones you put in. And I did it. And I had a good editor, a professional editor. So that helped. It's my first hard copy book. And even though my year was hectic, as I was telling you earlier, just dealing with illnesses in my family and, you know, church stuff.
Yeah.
At the end of the year, I have this book and a lot of other blessings, you being one of them, that I'm really thankful for at the end of the year. So I'm looking back, as we all do, I'm sure you do, you know, looking at the trajectory of the year and things I'm thankful for. And here we are. And you are, again, you are my first interview about the book. And so I'm very grateful for that.
Absolutely. I'm grateful to be your first interview and for you sending me an advanced copy. I can't wait to get my own hardbound copy. Your first hardbound book.
Yes, it is.
To release as well.
Yes, and it's about 218, 219 pages.
Yeah, it is fantastic. And now, granted, once again, like you said, quite a bit of these or all of this is sermons that you have conglomerated together on numerous topics of humanity.
I still had some left over, but these were the ones I wanted to fit in. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I love the fact that you divide it into sections of humanity. Whenever you start getting into the actual table of contents, things like that, the chapter points, number one, the chapters are so entirely, once again, digestible. If you are somebody who like, I tend to philosophy is one of my regular reads whenever I go to read. Fiction, for some reason, puts me to sleep. Don't know why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear
Maybe
you.
It's because, like, when I was a kid, I always enjoyed reading, like, instruction manuals, things like that. You know, it was something that I could wrap my hands around and actually do something with. And I guess that's why I view philosophy and theology kind of the same way, where it's like, here's a cool instruction manual that's going to give you some new tools in your tool belt. On how to break things down. And this absolutely, man, like even just going through section number one on religion, you know, a book of Revelation. You know, the G word, pebble in my shoe. Some of just the sermon titles in these are everyday things that we deal with as people. And one of the first sections that I found that I wanted to ask you about this, there was a paragraph up around page 25.
Okay.
Crucial with this reexamination is the historical figure of Jesus, around whom, of course, the entire Christian tradition is built. The demythologizing of Jesus, the stripping away of the incredible beliefs about him and the identification with the Trinity, for instance. It goes further to talk about how this is necessary to humanize not just Jesus, but the idea of Christ to begin with. Let's get into that real quick and kind of crack that nut and explore how Jesus became mythologized to begin with. Like I myself, as you know, am a former Roman Catholic seminarian. As I say on the show pretty regularly, I guess you would call me a recovering Catholic. I have come much more to, I would say, if anything, church-wise, probably much closer to Unitarian point of view, where I see, hey, man, as long as you are believing in something, like, bigger than you, that's the big push of the stone. Everything else just comes down to the flavor of ice cream, you know, at least in my mind. So let's get into how Jesus was mythologized to begin with and how we ended up in this situation, Reverend.
Well, now, you know, we have the gospel accounts and all of them are very different and very similar in a lot of ways. But I'm just going to jump to, you know, the Council of Nicaea.
Oh, absolutely.
In 325 CE. And, you know, where him being born of a virgin, him being, you know, very God, a very God begotten, not made, the dogma that came into into Orthodox Christianity with Constantine, you know, obviously Mary having to have been Saint Jerome, you know, being the one who translated virgin, mm-hmm. You know, Alma in Hebrew, but meaning young girl, but not having Jesus could not have been born by his mother having sex the old-fashioned way, even though we are told, I believe in Matthew, that he has had brothers and sisters. Yes. So I think with when the church was becoming the church, with all the hierarchy and the bishops and, you know, the priests and the emperors and all that, that's when this really, really got embedded. And anything, you know, there was the Arian and Arius controversy, it was the Gnostic yep. controversy, but anything that did not agree with what Rome was now putting out, as this is the official sanctified, if you will, story of Jesus, was just taken out.
Yeah.
Which is, now, we've seen that happen before in the Hebrew canon, but we're not talking about that, you know, in the 6th or 7th century BCE. But when all that stuff was rewritten to take out kind of the extraterrestrial stuff. But that's when it really got to be dogma. That's when it really got to be church doctrine. And this is what it meant to be a Christian. Yes, if we go to Acts 15, Peter and Paul are having their tete-a-tete about, you know, Peter saying, well, I was with the man, and Paul saying, you know, well, I met him on the road to Damascus. We start to get that push and pull, but it really becomes official, I think, with Constantine and, you know, in 325 CE, I really where there was there had to be a Trinity.
Yeah,
you know, that was one that was crucial to the theology: Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, which to me had always been a different mathematical formula that I really couldn't.
It was the only way that they could fight against Arianism at the time, which was the thought of Arianism. Just for those of you that are not aware of church history, things like that, that may not be fully hip to the Council of Nicaea and how we got to the books that we have. The big problem and why the whole creed was written, where light and from light, God from God, light from light, true God from true God, begotten, not God made. From God,
begotten, not made.
And the reason that became was because the Arian thought was that God was there. He was a creation. There was a good creation, a bad creation, but God basically assumed whichever face you needed him to assume. If you needed God to assume the face of the Holy Spirit, that's what he assumed. And the Council of Nicaea was like, no, it's much more mystical than that. It's the fact that there is a God of three, the three individual parts that take part in one being. And the way that it's always been simplistically explained to me by folk is being out on a frozen lake in a rowboat, where you have chunks of ice floating around in water and fog around you. You have all three different elements in a different aspect that are all made of the exact same thing. And that is the Trinity in action right there. They are all coexisting in the same space, all made of the exact same substance, but in a different quality.
And I mean, one could make that argument.
That's a rough philosophic road, though, man.
Well, I mean, I'll put it a little more crassly. When Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane before his arrest, who is he praying to?
Yeah.
Is he praying to himself?
Yeah. Yeah.
Who is he praying? I mean, it's just hard to wrap, you know, and I've heard, well, God's ways are not your ways, and, you know.
Sure.
And so Unitarianism just kept it simple. God is one. End of the story. There is one source by many different names. And there's unity in the diversity of creation, but there's one source. And I, that was easier for me to fathom. You know, and then universalism comes along and they say everybody's saved. I'm using the language of the day back when, over 200 years ago. And that made sense to me. They'd say God is love and everybody is saved. And that means that Pol Pot is saved. That means that Hitler is saved. That means because love does not barbecue you in eternity.
No, exactly. And the fact is, we, despite anything, despite any atrocities you commit as a human being, the one thing you will never, ever, ever get rid of because you have been breathed into by spirit is the seed of eternal grace. You will right. never get rid of that. You will never get rid of that seed
you can
of
do.
Potentiality.
Yeah.
No matter how indelible the mark is or how much you try to get rid of it, you will always have the sufficient grace that it takes.
Yes. And so I said, okay, this, I can wrap my mind around this. Mm. And it was also that I could question and I could ask questions and no one would look down on me and say I was blasphemous. I was a heretic. They would realize that I'm wrestling, that is normal. The unexamined faith is not worth having. And so that's how I came from the Baptist tradition to Jesus. Now, and then I started looking for, now this was before any UFO experiences and what have you. Mm. That came later. But I was trying to find what I could relate to. If I believe he rose from the dead or he was turning water into wine and those kinds of things, it would be easy to write off because I could just say, well, you're a God. That's you. Of course you can do that. Sure. But I was trying to get to the day in, day out life of what it must have been to be this man occupied, living in empire, which we do now. Wrestling with what it meant to be a human being. That's where I wanted to focus. And Unitarian and Unitarian Christianity, Universalism Christianity, gave me the space to do that without saying I was not in the club anymore. And then I had something to work with and because I knew people that were not Christian or whatever. And I said, these are good people. These are people who are full of love and they're precious. And you're going to tell me that a deity is going to banish them to eternal hellfire just because they don't believe it. And I just tried to keep fitting a round peg in a square hole and it just didn't. So I found Unitarian Universalism. Not a perfect denomination, but what is? But it gave me the intellectual acuity. Mm. We're coming from the Baptist tradition. You could think, but don't think too much.
Yeah.
If you think too much, you're going to be a problem because then you're going to start asking all these troublesome questions and what have you.
As a Catholic, you can think as long as it doesn't stray away from this four-finger-thick document called the Catechism. Well, as long as it doesn't stray from that big green book, you can still call yourself a capital C Catholic.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. It's interesting. But that, anyway, that's where I was. And which you, like you're talking about in your tradition, in every tradition. And I look at the Jewish tradition and I look at Jesus. Yes, he was born Jewish, but he was a different kind of Jewish person.
Yep.
And he a lot of the problem he got into was because of he was saying, hey, this is what Moses said, but I'm giving you a new way. So in some ways, he was trying to transform Judaism and the powers that be. Well, of course, there was always Rome, but, the more Orthodox, they were like, no, you can't do this. This is not what we're talking about. This is not what we're talking about. And I found myself in that same position. And I said, well, I don't have to reinvent the wheel. I can go back and look at these narratives.
Yeah.
And they will give me, I don't care whether they're Buddhist narratives or biblical, you can go back And you can say, here are some ways to live in 21st century America, and keeping your integrity, keeping a spirit of love.
Yeah.
Keeping your and so I started revisiting Christianity. Now, to some people, again, even without the UFO overlay, they would say, well, no, that's not Christianity. And then I would say, I used to always be on, I'd be reacting instead of responding, but I got to the part where I'm not going to let anybody else define me. You don't tell me what it means.
Yeah.
I'm not going to let these politicians or other people, you're not going to tell me. I can tell you. I used to play with it. Well, I'm not really a Christian. I'm a follower of the teachings of Jesus, which are two different things. But I see where I could incorporate and I could grow and learn and still hold on to those teachings. I remember the Dalai Lama saying that if you leave your religion of origin to become a Buddhist, he said, don't never talk bad about your religion of origin because it may not make sense to you, but it still makes sense to a lot of other people.
That's
but
right.
He said, why not use Buddhism to make you a better Christian? Why not make Buddhism make you better? He said, don't come over here until you absolutely have to. But he said, why don't you explore your tradition?
Yeah.
On a deeper level. And that's what I've been doing. I mean, I've gotten away from it. I was a Buddhist. I was an atheist. I was an agnostic. I was like, oh, I don't know. This is the, and I keep coming back to these teachings. Mm.
Yeah. And I mean, even right here, just the paragraph underneath what we were talking about, we came to realize, however, that what little we could find out about the historical Jesus revealed a man in a world view strangely different from our own understandings. And,
yes.
And yeah, when you look specifically, and this is something that we always talk about whenever we have you on talking about Bible, anybody talking about Bible, is that you cannot interpret the Bible through a modern lens.
No.
It is a document written by a certain group of people going through a certain thing politically, religiously,
yes,
that influenced every bit of that. Now, are there lessons that project forward to now? Absolutely.
Yes.
Like the prime example would be the Ten Commandments. Might be a little harsh for some people. However, when you consider the fact when the Ten Commandments came about that the Jews were still wandering for 40 years at the time,
right. Yes.
And were living in a caravan type lifestyle, where they pitched tent every night and picked it up and walked in the morning. They didn't have homes. They were living in a tent next to their neighbors. So if you were coveting your neighbor's wife, that may really do something bad for the caravan.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It was nomadic.
Yeah. Common sense rules like don't eat shellfish. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have refrigeration and we live in the desert. That's a pretty good rule.
Yes, yes.
You know?
And so we have to keep the context of what was going on then. And again, I'm not talking about with UAPs and stuff like that. That's something for another time. And so so I kept going back to those teachings. There's a sermon called The Pebble in My Shoe, and I talked about Christianity being that. Mm. That I remember preaching at a church, a UU church, and I at the end, because, you know, I have a flair for the dramatic, I took my shoe off and I pulled out a pebble. But because no matter how far I tried to get away from those teachings, I was always going back to them. You know, I always, and part of that is because of my upbringing. Part of that is that I was born in the West. I'm like you. I'm trained in Western civilization, Western philosophy, and so.
Like Dalai Lama said, to ignore your root is to quite literally ignore the core part of the plant.
There you go.
You know?
Can't hate the root without hating the tree.
Yeah.
Malcolm X said.
Yeah.
So, you know, but I'm grateful to Unitarian Universalism for giving me the room, for giving me the space to be able to work those things out without being told that I was somehow less than. Yeah. And I was encouraged to doubt. I was encouraged to look at my doubts. And that's what seminary was all about.
Oh, absolutely.
For me as well. So, you know, it was very influential in that part of at that time and that part of my life.
Well, and I think beautifully and once again, this, yes, is a collection of sermons. Remove the word UU or Universal Unitarianism whenever it's used. This is an everyday document about living life. It is absolutely amazing. It's absolutely beautiful. And some of the things that you get into with this, especially when it starts getting into social justice, when it starts moving into the realm of brotherly love, treating each other, especially with empathy and understanding the individual.
Yes.
Because once again, and I was just having this conversation. My live stream last week, I had somebody that called somebody a racist and went off on an organization and proceeded to go into a lot of really bad experiences that they had with like two people in an entire organization. And I was like, I find it interesting how you are calling one person racist, yet on the other hand, entirely, you are diminutizing an entire group of people in an organization because of your experience with two people within it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that is quite literally the root of racism is that distillation mentality and the fact of, you know, because one person of this type did this to me, everybody is like that. That's like that type.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And forgetting individual within that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, we could unpack that. I mean, individuals are part of systems. And so, you know, if we talk about racism as in a systems type of way, then you may be able to say, okay, I'm part of this structure, I'm part of this system. And yes, sure. I think that we could all agree with that, at least to a degree. But in the situation, I'll give an example.
Please.
I hope it's a good example. I was in Georgia outside of Athens on Thanksgiving, around Thanksgiving, with my wife. And we were, I thought, doing the speed limit. Okay.
Uh-oh.
And I was doing 62 miles an hour in a 55 mile an hour, you know, area.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
And, not going speed demon on it or anything.
Yeah. So a stereotypical good old boy cop, he pulled me over. And he said, you know, you were doing 80 in a 55 mile an hour zone. I said, officer, I beg to differ. I was doing 62 miles an hour, you know. And he said, no, you weren't. No, you weren't. And so I looked at my wife and she just said, and you know, he was pleasant.
Sure.
He wasn't like this good old boy kind of stereotype. I mean, he looked it and he had the accent of it, but he didn't, you know, you can feel these things sometimes. He did give me a ticket, but to make a long story short.
Good for him.
Man, he gave me a freaking ticket. Man, it was $500.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So I'm riding and, you know, it's near the holiday and I'm seeing, I swear to God, like six or seven people on our trip back were being pulled over. You know, they had to meet their quota.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No. That's the beautiful thing about an out-of-state person is they ain't coming back for traffic court.
There you go.
They're just going to pay the fine.
One could have made the argument that I'm a man of color. My wife is white. We're down here. And, yeah. you know, we could, I could have taken it to other places, but it wasn't about that. Yeah. I, you know, it, what goes around comes around. Sometimes you're the bear, sometimes the bear eats you. I mean, he wasn't, I didn't feel this hostility. And what are y'all doing down here? Now, granted, we did have North Carolina license plates. My wife is a animal lover, so she had a couple stickers, you know,
sure.
on the back. But brother, I, you know, I don't want to pay the $500, but I just left there thinking, he got me.
Yeah.
I mean, I
yeah.
wasn't speeding. I, you know, it was no way I was speeding, but this
not
is
like
life.
That. Yeah.
But, yeah. So that's what I'm saying. It's the knee-jerk reaction could be, well, that man, he saw me with these plates and I'm with my buddy. And it wasn't about that. So I think you always, well, you use the word grace. You know, you got to call things as you see it, but sometimes you got to wait and see. You can't believe everything you think.
Well, and you especially can't rush to judgment. To begin with, we have a big, big tendency to that in our society right now, especially in our modern doxing society. When it comes to justice, that seems to be a big modern form of justice is that kind of stuff. And it's like, you know, are you thinking about the other people in that household who had nothing at all to do with that person's decision?
Right.
You know, is that justice? And we it's hard sometimes. It's interesting because once again, you do not have to have enlightenment. Just to get back to the title of the book here, to have enlightenment, you do not have to have any grand epiphany. You do not have to be struck off a horse by the light of God and have the scales lifted from your eyes. You don't have to have a huge miraculous moment.
Right.
It's quite literally the fact of taking the moment to stop and realize, taking the moment to stop and think, like you're saying, to stop and process mm-hmm. even that experience that you just had in a different situation.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
in
man,
a different way.
You know, the $500 things, but that was it. But it wasn't that, you know, and you're right. And so I just had to say, even in those moments, because we've all had them, but you know, I'm just learning and trying to learn to respond to life instead of reacting.
Yes.
And that there's a desert and a sea between the two. And that's why I have the Thich Nhat Hanh quote there. You know, enlightenment is when one definition is when a wave realizes it's part of the ocean, that I am not separate from you, that we come from the same source, that we go back. Now, that's very abstract, and we're bringing it down to my ticket for your person having that moment. But in the end, it always comes back to that.
Yeah.
And so that's, to me, where the enlightenment comes from. And, of course, Jack Kornfield's book, After Enlightenment, The Laundry, that even if you did have this big epiphany, even if you did have this big, grandiose, life-changing event, you still got to go home and do your laundry.
Well,
you still got to brush your teeth in the morning. You still got to be in the world with the dirt and the smell of it on you.
One of the most humbling moments in my life, Reverend, came after the seminary. And, you know, as you probably know, many people, it doesn't really matter which religion seminary you leave from. When you leave frequently, you know, people go through a lot personally. There has been moments of revelation in your life. You have felt called to something that now for some reason you are no longer called to. And you can be lost in many, many ways. Now, I spent many years as an assistant youth minister. I taught religion. I taught, you know, helped teach RCIA, helped teach confirmation, all kinds of things. But I was sitting in church one day, and this is when that moment that you were talking about with the Dalai Lama hit me, where, you know, typically I would have looked around and felt some kind of angst for people just going through motions, things like that. People wearing shorts, whatever. I suddenly had this huge moment of empathy, and the feeling of needing to pray for people that could only experience their capital G God in that way and in that space and through that doctrine. You know, and there are those people, as the Dalai Lama said, pray for them. Don't admonish them for not getting to the point that you're at or anything. That's not enlightened. You need to make sure that they are cared for in the way that they need. And if they need to go to that facility on a Wednesday night for Bible study, on a Sunday for church, on a Saturday for choir practice, and be with people of like mind and like community, then that is what they spiritually need. And to admonish somebody for that, or to think them less for that, I find that to be the unenlightened path.
Right. And then, you know, you have to start rethinking, am I in the right occupation? No, I agree.
Yeah.
And we have that. And so, you know, I will say this about Unitarianism. It's always been a denomination that is very focused on social justice and feeding the hungry, and I get all that. I love it. However, and I know some people who that's all they would come to church for. See, I don't do that. I come to church like there. I go to church so I can get my fuel, my food to get me through the next week or whatever. And then whatever I do with that energy is, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I because of the focus on social justice, you know, sometimes we can forget about how do I get my nourishment? Because whether you do social justice or not, there are going to be ups and downs. There are going to be rough times. There are going to be times when you're taking 3 steps forward and 12 steps back.
Yeah.
And what do you fall back on? Because the times get discouraged. And I think that's where the spirituality and religion, a healthy religion, can sustain you.
Well, and, you know, you actually brought that up in this part of the sermon right here. So perhaps a second look at spirituality and religion may be the key. I'm speaking now of the deeper meaning of religion, not the present interpretations of Christianity or Islam. Many people think that in order to make religion more popular, we should modernize it even more. The very thing that human beings do not need to do. The idea that somehow all of religions are incomplete and they all have to get together to create a total religion is not true. Why? Because the traditions came from the sacred and they are there to lead us back to the sacred.
Yes, 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 yes. I think, and as I mentioned before, you know, and I was just talking to someone else about this the other day. But, you know, people were saying, well, what do I need? They were looking for a formula. How do I do this to get through in the world? How do I, you know, like if I do A plus B will equal C? And I said, I don't know if there's a formula. Yeah, that's right. And that's what I was trying to tell them. But I did say, but you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You don't have to. You can go back and look at the narratives of human beings, whether they're religious narratives, philosophical narratives, art, philosophy. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. You can go back to those teachers and those individuals, and that same knowledge you can apply to now. You don't have to modernize it in the sense of where it's a situational type of ethics or whatever. There were some things that were said and done 5,000 years ago that are true now, and they'll be true 5,000 years from now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And those are the eternal truths that you want to hold on to. What I do to my neighbor, I do to myself. Okay, which is a very, very basic one. You know, all else is commentary. Was it Rabbi Hillel had said, one of his wise rabbis, that do unto others as you would have them do unto you, the rest is commentary. You know, that you reap what you sow. Those are universal truths. What you come out to you will come back. You know, those are things like that that you hold, that you can hold on to. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That if you're chasing after wealth and all these other things. And so the template's already there. What we have to do is to apply it.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And, you know, it's interesting because many people in a lot of faiths out there, Reverend, think these things. But much like the experiencer, they are afraid to come forward to their community
yeah.
and
yes.
say them.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
They yes. for fear of ridicule yes. by their yes. by their fellow community and fellow believers.
Yes, and even clergy.
Oh, yeah.
Who may have had experiences that don't fit. It doesn't have to be UFO. It could be near death. It could be a psychic or whatever. And they can't come out and say it.
Yeah.
Because they'll lose their jobs.
Well, I mean, the prime example would be the instance that led me into the seminary. I was serving mm-hmm. at Mass. I was a junior in high school and was just transported is the only way I can put it. Mm-hmm. I saw everybody. I was still in that place, but I was amongst a different hue of reality.
Yeah.
I was in a totally different place and what I considered to be what I found later in life to be just the true presence of my God.
Yeah.
I've had it outside of that sanctuary space. I've had it all kinds of places. But it is, and I remember going to Father John Upton after Mass, and thank God it was him.
Yeah.
Seriously. I mean, Father Joe would have listened. But I don't think he would have seen it as deep a spiritual moment
right.
as Father you. John did, where he was like, wow, Chris, that is amazing and beautiful. Like, I wish I could have an experience like that
mm-hmm.
With my God. Like mm-hmm. that, it was really beautiful the way that he put it to me. And thank God I felt comfortable enough with conversations I'd had with Father John outside of the doors of the sanctuary, you know, where I knew that he might be open to something like
yeah.
that, you know,
yeah.
Because when I got to the seminary and tried to tell that to some friends, it definitely no. wasn't received with the same verve. Let's just say, you
yeah,
know,
that's a good way to put it.
And it can be hard because that is a stealing moment in your life, you know? It can be hard when that moment is not believed. It can be hard when that revelation, even if it is the simple everyday revelation that you have, yeah. that is mentioned in these beautiful sermons that you've put out.
Yeah,
it can be
yeah.
hard when that's not validated.
Yeah, and meanwhile, we're reading from a book where people were having fantastic experiences.
Yeah,
do you know yes. what I mean? They were having all these psychic yeah. experiences. They were having contact with other beings and other yeah. people and seeing things in the sky. But it's almost like, yeah, well, that happened back then, but that's not happening now.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah, 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 yeah. You may, you know, Jesus may put his hands on somebody with cancer and it'll go away, but don't think you can do that. When he clearly states that greater thing. So and that's why I think people leave their religions of origins many times. Some people say, no, I'm going to stick with it and I'm going to work with it or work within it or not. But a lot of people leave because, you know, they're not getting the validation. They're not getting the affirmation. They're getting up a bunch of thou shalt nots.
Yeah.
And the joy is taken away from religion. Who was it? Alan Watts said that true religion is about laughter.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's about joy. We call it the gospel. What does that mean? It means good news.
Well,
but
yep.
you look at these people and they don't look like they're having fun.
I say it all the time. I was raised Roman Catholic. You want to talk about some people with some whacked out beliefs in some places? Brother,
yes.
brother, we front yes. of the line. We tip of the spear, man. you know?
Yeah.
And those are things that you have to be able to reconcile with. Those are things that, you know, like, despite fallacies, you still have faith because your faith is your faith.
Yes.
You know, and you do have to kind of. It's
experience.
You know, like I tell people all the time, and even on this show, my faith in my God is absolute.
Yes.
My faith in the flawed instrument called the capital C Church.
Yeah.
Greatly diminished.
Yeah.
Greatly
I was watching, I don't know if you saw this, The Pope's Exorcist. With Russell Crowe.
I have not watched it yet.
Yeah. And I watched it twice. It's pretty good. They're going to do a sequel. But there is one, you know, and it's Hollywood eyes and what have you. But it was interesting and it was entertaining. But he's in front of this tribunal. And one of his buddies is this cardinal. And he's a man of color. And I don't know whether he's African or African-American. Beautiful looking man. And, you know, they've been in the trenches together. And he said, well, if they come after you, I'll be there to defend you. Because he knows that Russell Crowe's character can be kind of out there. Mm. And Russell Crowe looks him dead in the eye and he says to him, my faith needs no defense.
Yeah.
And it was like, whoa. Yeah. I don't need you to defend my faith.
Yeah.
And it was a very, very powerful moment. Anyway, if you get a chance, watch it.
It is on my short list of things.
Yeah. It's worth it. But getting back, you know, I wanted to take a slice of life. I took philosophy. I took religion. I took justice. I took holidays. I took and I just wanted to give a universal kind of. You know, it says right there, personal spiritual growth, the nature of justice, because they're universal truths that you can pick up this book and you can be an Orthodox, whatever. You can be a liberal. You can be a Wiccan. You can be whatever you are. And you will find something in this book for you. And that's the beauty, I think, of Unitarian Universalism. But it's also the beauty of what it means to be a human being.
Well, and to have the conversation, Reverend.
That's all we want.
That is what it's about. And honestly, I put like 18 stars around this part in my little tablet reader because I loved it so much. This is quite literally like the reason I started Dudes and Beer. And continued it on as Curious Realm.
That's how it was
this right here, and I'd like to read it. It's from the Pebble in My Shoe sermon.
Okay.
It's a story about you and some friends after September 11th, and he was wearing the flag to let other Americans know that one could be progressive and liberal and still love and care for his nation. I was shocked. I challenged him by saying, who is going to know your politics just by you wearing the flag? He responded that perhaps a conversation would ensue and a meeting of the minds would follow.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, is the most beautiful and poignant part of this book. Because it's absolutely true. We have to be willing to have the conversation so much that we are willing to put ourselves and even our politics out there.
And
like you're saying, not in reaction, but in understanding.
And responding,
And responding. And,
yes.
and in genuine empathy, because when you're empathetic with someone, I don't care why somebody believes something. I just want to know what they believe.
I don't want to change their paradigm. Yeah, tell me how you got there.
Yeah.
Because then that's how a conversation starts. Yeah, my friend Will, I didn't get a chance to see him. He lives in Brooklyn. And I didn't get a chance to see him. But, yeah, he's one of those kind of guys. And it just blew me away.
Yeah.
Because he's a very progressive individual, his politics, his life. But he would wear a flag. And I remember that. And that's it. You know, and it was a part of what I was saying earlier. I'm not going to let someone else define me by telling me this is what patriotism looks like. No, I get to define that.
That's right.
We can talk about it. And I just want people to be able to do that, or to at least talk about it. Because when we talk about God or non-God, you can always tell when we made God in our own image, because God always hates the same people we hate.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's when you know
you suddenly end up with this really narrow-minded God.
Yeah. That's when you know, well, wait a minute, maybe I need to revisit this.
You know who I don't like? The Hittites. Maybe you should just go slaughter all of them. How about that?
Yeah, why not? What are you doing this weekend? So, and we're very close to that now.
We are.
If we're not very careful.
We're very, very close to that, Michael.
If we're not careful.
We are walking a razor's edge of, on one side, wanting that confirmation of belief on both sides, infrared and ultraviolet at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
While at the same time walking the fine line of not caring about each other at all, mm-hmm. if somebody believes something different than you. And mm-hmm. that is such a precarious and dangerous place as humanity,
yes.
for the conversation of humanity.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that, you know, I have hope when I get up in the morning.
Same.
And, I want to be part of the solution and not part of the problem. That doesn't mean I don't get discouraged. It doesn't mean that after a couple cocktails or a couple beers, I don't go off sometimes and go crazy and talk and my frustrations come out. But the next day, I'm back in the game.
Yeah,
I can't afford not to be. And really none of us can be.
Well, we're all allowed to be angry and to feel angry. It's whether or not you choose to live your life in anger.
There you go. What's the old Zen set thing? 7 times down, 8 times up.
That's it.
And so there it is. I want people to buy the book, but I want them to see it as, and I can't control it, but I'm almost sure that they will find something in it for them, and it'll bring us together.
There are some beautifully, beautifully amazing messages in here, and I cannot wait to read it again and find more parts to underline and highlight for myself, just as my daily credos and meditations, because, yeah.
Thank you, brother.
It is, like, every day is an exercise in mindfulness. Every day.
Yeah. Every day.
And mindfulness day. Of loving yourself, mind, because when you love yourself, you're okay with everything around you.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And we have to love ourselves enough to love our neighbor enough to let them be happy.
Yeah. You know why? Because as Thich Nhat Hanh says on the front of the book, enlightenment is when a wave realizes that it's part of the ocean.
That's right.
And we when we realize that we are all part of the same source, there's unity in the diversity. Diversity doesn't mean divisive, and it doesn't mean that you don't have your own unique self, your own unique gifts. Everybody's unique.
When we
keep that in mind, I think we may treat each other just a bit more gentle.
Yep. And we are all e pluribus unum. We are
out of
one. We are many. And
yes,
each penny that struck is unique and different in its own special little way, you know, but they all equal up to a dollar when you get 100 of them.
There you go.
You know, and we are all pennies, man. We are all the same equivalent value, every one of
there
us. So
yeah.
This book is beautiful. I love it. I love the teachings inside of it. I'm glad that we got together. I mean, so many times we get together, we touch on these topics, we get into these topics. But I'm glad that we had the time to sit down today and actually, like, crack this one open, because it is one of those, like, this is why I started this show, is the communication of humanity and the understanding that we are not supposed to be homogenous. We are not supposed to all believe the same thing for the same reason. It is the journey. And if you don't care about how somebody got to where they're at, you're the problem.
Well, and you know, this is your ministry.
Yeah. Thank you.
This is your ministry.
I have taken that to heart
since the last time you've told it to me.
That's why you went to seminary, man.
You don't have.
It's not always in the church. Ministry is not always in the church or not. This is your ministry, and that education prepared you for this.
Yeah, absolutely.
That we could even have these conversations. That this is your ministry.
That's it. That's it. And you know, we are all called to vocation. We're all called to spread the word of how we got to where we are with other people so that we grow as a humanity. And that's Amen. What's important. Thank you so much for your time, as always.
Oh, brother, thank you for having me on.
At any time and always. Whenever you feel moved to talk, you feel free to message me and we'll talk.
I will, brother. And I'm wishing you and your family a gentle peace this holiday season.
Same. Let everybody know where they can follow you, where they can go to keep up with everything, where they can go to find sermons. Aside from the new amazing book, Enlightenment.
Well, you know what? They can, obviously, Barnes & Noble's and Amazon. But we stream our services on Sunday. So if you want to not only hear the word, but you want to watch me at church and attend one of our services, just type in Unitarian Universalist Congregation of the Swannanoa Valley. I know that's a lot of words, but it's in the book. And on Sunday, like Sunday afternoon, we're 11 to 12, you can actually attend the service. We have a Christmas Eve service too. And you can find me on Facebook at Reverend Michael J. Carter, or, you know, Michael Carter. I post mostly on Reverend Michael J. Carter. But check that out. And you can always send me an email at MichaelJSCarter@gmail.com. And I will respond.
Awesome. Yes, he does respond, folks. Once again, thank you so much for your time. Hold the line.
Thank you,
while we close everything out with the audience. Okay. And we'll chat for a second. While you are online checking out all of the amazing work and getting the amazing books like Initiation and more from Michael J.S. Carter, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. That's where you can stop by the store and buy all of our guest books. There are easy links right there. You can also go to curiousrealm.com/video, and you can see all of our guests' YouTube pages embedded right there and follow them, watch all their videos, everything else. Like, follow, subscribe, share, everybody. And remember, share your hearts, share your minds this holiday season. That's what it is about. That's what every day is about. It's about the conversation of humanity and what we can do to lift each other up, not tear each other down. So remember that this year, and take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app. Available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.